All right, I'm going to do my best here. Emily's offering song wrecked me, so I might cry my whole way through. I'm going to do my best. That's the prayer of my heart. Oof. Okay, so the lectionary gives us two passages today. One comes from Ecclesiastes, one of my favorite books. It's very philosophical. It's like a French philosopher smoking a cigarette in a cafe, like, everything is meaningless. It's like Jean-Paul Sartre or something. Oh, why do you wear those orange suspenders? So I like it, because that's my personality, right? Like, think about these things. Solomon is actually the author. It's an Old Testament passage, right? This is during Israel's monarchy. So you get Saul as the first king, David as the second king. Solomon is David's son, the third king. Doesn't take long for Israel to have power in a monarchy for it to go totally astray. Solomon's an okay king, but tons of wives, lots of idolatry. But he's also known to be like super wise because he asked God for wisdom above all else, right? So here's this person who's a king, who is rich, who is powerful, who has a giant harem. All of this, and yet here he is talking about my toil, all my work, all of these things, I'm going to die and it's just going to go to someone else. It's like meaningless, right? What has any meaning at all? And he's like wrestling with this very deep question. This is going to be sort of the question of the sermon. It's not like we haven't talked about this before, but the Bible just keeps hammering on it. So what do you want me to do? I'm going to have to hammer on it. So if you feel hammered on it, don't blame me. It's the lectionary. I don't even choose the passages during the lectionary. But the question is like, what has meaning? What's important? What does it really mean to be human? How should I live? What has real value, right? This is like a core human question that sadly we spend very little time thinking about. The Bible spends a lot of time talking about it and thinking about it. So you got Solomon writing Ecclesiastes. And do you remember what his wisdom is in Ecclesiastes? What should we do then since most things are meaningless?
Eat, drink,
and enjoy the toils of your labor. So here we are, Ecclesiastes 2, this is from today. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him who can eat or find enjoyment? You can skip the second slide of that, Mike. Eat, drink, enjoy the labor. Well, you can imagine if you're king of Israel and you got a lot of that and you can't find much meaning in life and many of the problems that you face you can't really solve, maybe that would be a good... I mean, that makes sense. It's how I feel. It's how I feel when I'm confronted with systemic racism, gun violence, right? Poverty. I think to myself, I can't fix any of those things. They're huge. But I can be a good dad, go on vacation with my kids, eat, drink, and be merry. Well, luckily, Solomon thinks that's a pretty good idea, right? He mentions it multiple times in Ecclesiastes as he ruminates, French cafe style, about the meaningless of most things. Love, meaningless. Work, meaningless, blah. But here we go, right? This is Ecclesiastes 5 now. Same thing. This is what I've observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat and drink, find satisfaction in their labor. Okay? Did you already skip Ecclesiastes 3? I'm sorry. I want 3. There's 3. I know that this is nothing better for people than to be happy to do what while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in their work. So you got it in Ecclesiastes 2, you get it in Ecclesiastes 3, you get it in Ecclesiastes 5, 8, and 12. Making a point here. But here's the problem. Jesus, in Luke 12, tells the parable and directly confronts this very issue. So in the Old Testament, we get the wisdom of Solomon, but in Luke, we get the wisdom of Jesus. Remember, this is the parable of the rich man. He calls him the foolish rich man. Then he, the rich man, said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and I'll make bigger ones because I got lots of stuff and lots of money. You realize how much U-Haul and like how much storage space people in the United States rent out, right? This is us. We'll just put it in storage. And there I will store my surplus grain and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. Huh. That sounds a lot like directly confronting Solomon. And this is what Jesus says. But God says to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God." You're going to die, your stuff's going to be here, and someone else is going to get it. So there's more to life than, right? So the Bible's not univocal. I wish it was just like one voice. Be great. Got lots of authors, lots of time, different cultures. So this is my question for you. You get to respond now. It's my congregational question. Why these two pieces of wisdom? What's going on with these scriptures? Can you give me some insight? Great.
Sorry.
Mike.
So maybe by saying, you know, eat, drink, and be content with your toil, Solomon isn't saying indulge yourself in all these things. He's saying, you know, be content with the food that you have, be content with the drink that you have, be content with the work that you have.
Yeah. You hope that maybe Solomon means something like try to be grateful and joy-filled for what you have, right? Like you can get caught up in all the things that you feel are meaningless or that tear you down, but maybe in the midst of that, you recognize I have food and I have drink and I have work and I have family and I try to enjoy that. Maybe there's something important there that the rich person in the parable has maybe perverted in some way Solomon's wisdom. Making it about hoarding. What else? Yeah.
For a lot of my life, I thought that the Bible was just had like a singular view that was true all the time. In the past couple of years, I've been able to see how the Bible oftentimes seems to contradict itself.
Yeah.
But the beauty of a tradition and a faith-based tradition that allows contradictions to happen within a text. And invite us into a place where we have to feel like, wait, those things don't match. So how do I feel or experience this? It's an invitation to experience something rather than something like, oh, I agree with that, or yes, I agree with that. You have to wrestle with these two things that don't seem like they fit. And then out of that, you're participating rather than just agreeing with an idea.
Yeah, yeah. If you couldn't hear that, DJ said, you know, I used to believe that the Bible just had one view. Which is funny, because many Christians think that, yet they disagree with each other. So then, like, which Christian view? But I love the idea that says, well, and I believe this, by the way, this is like a conviction of my heart, that the Bible, more than anything, is an invitation to be in relationship with you, to be in conversation with you, to be in dialogue with you. That it doesn't make it easy. It intentionally makes it hard. Will you engage with these passages that conflict, so that you have to ask questions, you have to go to the community, you have to begin exploring. It means you have to wrestle, you have to think critically, you have to engage. It's almost like a problem to be solved. We got some engineers here, right? There's a problem, you're like, I don't know, let's try this. And we try it, and it's like, you know what that produced? Hatred and bigotry and division and, well, maybe we'll try this. Oh, that produced... So like part of it is like we have to like be open-minded and engage the text. And it says, well, what about this? Could it mean that? I don't think that's bad. I think that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are just not willing to do the work. Mm-hmm. It's a relationship. It's a dialogue. So now I have to wrestle. So Mike says, what about this? And I heard some of you say, ooh, that's what we call discernment. The community says, that resonates, that hits me, I like that. Someone else might say something different, we say, ooh. And at different times in my life, it might be like, yes, I see that, that's wisdom. But it's different over here. That's miraculous. That's not a problem, right? It's just how you see it. Jews, yeah.
It's kind of to piggyback on what DJ was saying, but the sense of, I like how a lot of times the character, like the people that you read in the Bible, will respond to things so similarly to the way that I do. You know, so I don't know where Solomon's going with all of this, but the whole sense of, yeah, when there's just nothing but mass, just awfulness, and everything seems pointless and frustrating, like I prefer to get a giant bag of Cheetos and like binge watch Netflix and be like, I don't know what to do.
Preach.
I don't know how to engage with this. And that we don't have to say that that's like good or bad or right or wrong, black, white, that that is. But that then you have the story of Jesus where Jesus is always saying, but maybe we can, maybe there's not an either, maybe it's not we can solve all of this in one fell swoop, which is impossible, or we just give up and do nothing. Maybe there's another option. Maybe there's, maybe let's try and look at something in a deeper way or a higher way or from another angle, and that we're challenged in these ways, but that there's also the sense of, but humans are humans, and we, like, that our default is gonna oftentimes be like path of least resistance, and when things are hard and we get scared and we shut down, and I don't feel quite so alone in it. Like when I read it like that, rather than is Solomon, is this the right way or is this the right way? You know, that when we get to read it with a sense of this is how people, this is how we are trying to learn how to respond to God and to the world and where we are, and that we can say, but that Jesus is always going to offer us this kind of new perspective that is inviting us into it. We don't have to think, well, Solomon was bad and Jesus is good, and so therefore we can. It's just, sometimes it just is, and I feel comfort in that, you know, when they
left. Yeah, that's good. So let me give a hypothesis then. Solomon gives wisdom that might be helpful to many people in terms of learning how to have joy in the midst of feeling like the world is often meaningless or that we're alone, that appreciating even things like food and toil of labor, like work, appreciating those things, being grateful is important. And yet, that same wisdom can be perverted, and Jesus seems to be confronting that. The rich man quotes Solomon, hey, I'll just build bigger barns and, you know, I've got a lot, I'll just eat, drink, and be merry. And Jesus is like, I don't think that means what you think it means, right? Like, I'm not sure that's how we apply this. But there's something, there's a call on your life that you're not hearing, that you're not getting. So in one place of despair, just being grateful for the ability to work is appropriate. But yet in this case, taking advantage of the fact that I have lots of things, so I'll eat, drink, and be merry, isn't okay. But do you see how complicated that gets? It's like this heart issue, this deep, what is in your heart? So I'm going to make a claim that I made 2 weeks ago. And we're going to listen to a little bit of a book. The author reads it, which is going to be way better than if I read it. So I'm going to ask you to like really tune your concentration skills because it's powerful. But I want to make a claim first, and that is I really believe that every person who calls themselves a Christian has a call to a downgoing. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is that we're not called to climb up the ladder, we're called to climb down. So I mentioned this 2 weeks ago, right? And the text brings it back here. We're not to build bigger barns, to simply eat, drink, and be merry, but we have a call to those below, those that are hurting, those that are, like even the poor widow who gives a few pennies is praised by Jesus because even she in her poverty can give. We all have a place to give and to share. It's not all the same though. So some people's downgoing is like, you need to go and be a missionary in Ukraine. But for some of you, it might just be like, can you stand up for the kid at school who gets picked on? Or for some of you, it might just be like, you live in a family that doesn't treat women well. Like, are you willing to stand up for that and call that out? It's a downgoing. Some of you have family members that are racist and you tolerate it. Maybe a downgoing is to no longer do that, to speak Christ, to be uncomfortable, to not just eat, drink, and be merry. For some, it might, I don't know what it is. I'm suggesting that if you're a Christian, you have a call. God is calling you, and it's downward. And I don't want that call, right? So then the key is to pray, right? Is for you to really listen, to be aware of the people in your life that are often the target. So Brian Stevenson, he wrote a book called Just Mercy, which I love and I highly recommend. He isn't a lawyer. He mostly works with people on death row who are poor and people of color. There's a picture of him. I wish I could hug him. I'm going to try to stalk him somehow, find where he's speaking, because I really just think he's a living saint, a Christian man, graduated from Harvard Law, and said, my calling is to be poor, essentially. He makes very little money because representing people on death row that have no money doesn't pay well. So that's what he spends his life doing, and he tells stories in the book that are heart-wrenching and beautiful. He's intentionally celibate because his work demands that he is available 80 hours a week. He drives all across the South to prisons to visit people just because he wants to develop relationships with prisoners, those he represents. No wife, no children, all by choice to give himself fully to the work that God has called him to, right? He could have done whatever he wanted with a Harvard Law degree. He had a call to go downward. So I always think, like, some of you are physicians, and maybe there's a way to work at a clinic. Some of you are teachers, and maybe there's a reason that we chose Taft. We didn't choose Collister, right? There's a reason, because Taft doesn't have a PTA. They don't raise money themselves, not well. There's a reason, there's a down going, there's a call. What is God asking? I don't know. But Bryan Stevenson felt it deeply. So the passage we're going to listen to, he's reading it. He has just gotten out of court where he got two people who were sentenced to life in prison without parole as 13-year-olds. I want you to think about that. He has now won the case and they've been set free. They are now in their 60s. They've been in jail for decades. So it's a win. They're free. But he feels it deeply in his soul, but they lost how much time? So it's after the court case, and he sees a African-American woman, an older woman, just sitting outside the courtroom, just sitting there, and he doesn't recognize her. He's like, she's not a family member of the defendants. I don't know why she's in this courtroom or why she's here. So he just stops and approaches her like, hey, you know, who are you? And she was in the court and saw what happened. And what you're going to hear is this interaction between Bryan Stevenson and this woman. You have to be patient. This thing keeps logging me out. So, technology is never my friend.
Okay.
She said. I sat down beside her on the steps. I've seen you here several times. Are you related to Mr. Caston or Mr. Carter? I asked. No, no, no. I'm not related to nobody here. Not that I know of, anyway. She had a fine smile, and she looked at me intensely. I just come here to help people. This is a place full of pain, so people need plenty of help around here. Well, that's really kind of you. No, that's what I'm supposed to do, so I do it. She looked away before locking eyes with me again. My 16-year-old grandson was murdered 15 years ago, she said, and I love that boy more than life itself. I wasn't expecting that response and was instantly sobered. The woman grabbed my hand. I grieved and grieved and grieved. I asked the Lord why he let someone take my child like that. He was killed by some other boys. I came to this courtroom for the first time for their trials and sat in there and cried every day for nearly 2 weeks. None of it made any sense. Those boys were found guilty for killing my grandson, and the judge sent them away to prison forever. I thought it would make me feel better, but it actually made me feel worse. She continued. I sat in the courtroom after they were sentenced and just cried and cried. A lady came over to me and gave me a hug and let me lean on her. She asked me if the boys who got sentenced were my children, and I told her no. I told her the boy they killed was my child. She hesitated. I think she sat with me for almost 2 hours. For well over an hour, we didn't neither one of us say a word. It felt good to finally have someone to lean on at that trial, and I've never forgotten that woman. I don't know who she was, but she made a difference. I'm so sorry about your grandson, I murmured. It was all I could think of to say. Well, you never fully recover, but you carry on, you carry on. I didn't know what to do with myself after those trials, so about a year later, I started coming down here. I don't really know why. I guess I just felt like maybe I could be someone, you know, that somebody hurt and could lean on. She looped her arm with mine. I smiled at her. That's really wonderful. It has been wonderful. What's your name again? It's Bryan. It has been wonderful, Bryan. When I first came, I'd look for people who had lost someone to murder or some violent crime. Then it got to the point where some of the ones grieving the most were the ones whose children or parents were on trial. So I just started letting anybody lean on me who needed it. All these young children being sent to prison forever. All this grief and violence. Those judges throwing people away like they're not even human. People shooting each other, hurting each other, like they don't care. I don't know, it's a lot of pain. I decided that I was supposed to be here to catch some of the stones people cast at each other. Mm. I chuckled when she said it. During the McMillan hearings, a local minister had held a regional church meeting about the case and had asked me to come speak. There were a few people in the African-American community whose support of Walter was muted, not because they thought he was guilty, but because he had had an extramarital affair and wasn't active in the church. At the church meeting, I spoke mostly about Walter's case, but I also reminded people that when the woman accused of adultery was brought to Jesus, he told the accusers who wanted to stone her to death, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." The woman's accusers retreated, and Jesus forgave her and urged her to sin no more. But today, our self-righteousness, our fear, and our anger have caused even the Christians to hurl stones at the people who fall down, mm-hmm. even when we know we should forgive or show compassion. I told the congregation that we can't simply watch that happen. I told them we have to be stone catchers. When I chuckled at the older woman's invocation of the parable, she laughed, too. "I heard you in that courtroom today. I've even seen you here a couple times before. I know you as a stone catcher, too." I laughed even more. "Well, I guess I try to be." She took my hands and rubbed my palms. "Well, it hurts to catch all them stones people throw." She kept stroking my hands, and I couldn't think of anything to say. I felt unusually comforted by this woman. It would take me nearly 5 hours to drive back to Montgomery once I got things settled for Mr. Caston and Mr. Carter. I needed to keep moving, but it felt nice sitting there with a woman now earnestly massaging my palms in a way that was so sweet, even though it seemed strange, too. "Are you trying to make me cry?" I asked.
Oh, I like that I cued Mike, even though the computer's up here. You're not a magician, Mike, I know that. So, a man with a Harvard Law degree decides to work with people with no money and little hope of being released. A woman who spends her days sitting in a courtroom just waiting for someone in pain to lean on her because they want to be stone catchers. Man, I love that line. I'm going to use it a lot. I'm going to use it a lot. Because a lot of stones get thrown in our culture at lots of people, and it's time that we started catching some. Like, at some point, my commitment to God will be measured by how many calluses my hands have from the stones I've tried to catch. And right now, my hands are a little too soft. Right? A little too moisturized. Our call is to be a shield between those that might hurl stones or bullets and those that might receive them. We're the ones who stand in the way to catch them. Jesus is a stone catcher, not a stone thrower. So here's my way to do it. Like, okay, Joe, how do we do this? One way is just to think about engaging people in relationship. So like, I say this a lot, so I'll try to give some very concrete examples. So like, our Taft ministry is amazing. It's great. If you're a part of it, I'm going to issue an additional challenge. Know one student at Taft and know their story and develop a relationship with them. Know one staff member and their story and develop a relationship with them. An ongoing, where you know what they might need, how to care for them, how to love them. I might encourage you to choose a student who you see as being alone or in some other way marginalized because of language barrier or whatever it might be. I know some of you feed the homeless. Some of you are engaged. It's awesome. I challenge you to engage in relationship with at least one of the people you feed. Know their name and know their story. Make yourself uncomfortable and engage so you know their need. Go a little deeper in that relationship. Bryan Stevenson is who he is, not because he just, right, defends people he doesn't know. It's because he spends time getting to know people on death row and their stories. He spends time there. Do you know how hard that is to go to a prison and sit for hours listening to someone's story? This is what he does, but that's how you affect his heart, and that's how he gives so much passion to his job. So that's what we have to do. Some of you, it might be something, again, as small as like engaging people in your family that have been marginalized or excluded, right? Engaging them in hard conversation, developing real relationship with people in your life, at your work, that are difficult. To become a stone catcher. Right? Some of you maybe need us to catch stones for you. That's okay too. I just need to know. I don't know how to catch stones if I don't know where they're coming from. So you got to let us know. That's what we're called to do. Right? It means being strong. It means being bold. It means being courageous. It means doing things that make you uncomfortable. It means showing up to church events. It means coming to potlucks, going to the family fun night, doing things like a yard sale. The more you show up and engage, the deeper you connect, the more you are able to catch those stones and to have the stones thrown at you deflected, right? We become barriers for one another. So that's my challenge. That's what I'd like to see. That's what I want this place to become, right? We're going to approach the table today. Hey Blake, will you hold the cup for me? Not right now, I'll call you up later. All you have to do is say, Christ's blood poured out for you, okay? 600 times, that's it. We're going to come to the table today, right? In memory of maybe the greatest stone catcher. Ah, yes! Oh, God. If you couldn't hear it, Mike goes, maybe? Question mark? Definitely. The greatest stone catcher, right? The one who models it. The one who says, I lay down my life that you might live. I give my life as a living sacrifice that you might flourish, that you might be set free, that you might be forgiven, that you might be liberated. The hope of forgiveness, of grace and redemption resides here. Because God was willing to catch stones. When you take communion today, and you're all welcome to do it, I encourage you, maybe light a candle. Maybe there's someone that comes to mind that you know you need to stand up for or develop a relationship with or begin to go deeper. Light a candle. Make a commitment. Set your jaw. Right? We do this not only to remember what Jesus did, but as a calling for our own lives, our own hearts. This calls us to action. So don't forget that. You're making a commitment. You're welcome to take communion. Everyone's welcome. I don't care what you believe or what you've done. But be careful, because you're making a commitment. You're saying, Jesus was a living sacrifice. I too am a living sacrifice. Right? This is a call. If you have your hymnals, I forgot to put them on the screen. I apologize. I forgot the slides. You can listen. You know what? Just listen. You can read if you'd like, but honestly, I'm going to be on page 10. But here are the words. On the night in which Jesus gave himself up for us, he took bread, he gave thanks to you and broke it, gave it to his disciples and said, take, eat. This is my body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And when supper was over, he took the cup, gave thanks to you, gave it to his disciples, and said, drink from this, all of you. This is the blood of the new covenant, poured out for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. And so in remembrance of these, your mighty acts in Jesus Christ, we offer ourselves in praise and thanksgiving as a holy and living sacrifice in union with Christ's offering for us as we proclaim the mystery of our faith. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. Pour out your Holy Spirit on us gathered here and on these gifts of bread and wine. Make them be for us the body and blood of Christ, that we may be for the world the body of Christ redeemed by his blood. By your Spirit, make us one with Christ, one with each other, and one in ministry to all the world until Christ comes in final victory and we feast at his heavenly banquet. Through your Son, Jesus Christ, with the Holy Spirit and your Holy Church, all honor and glory is yours, Almighty Father, Almighty God, excuse me, now and forever. Amen. We're going to start with this group here, and you'll take the bread and the cup and go this way. Hey, babe, let me trade spaces with you. Can you do the bread? Thank you. I'm a little bit of a mess.
Sweat or tears or what's your problem?
It's all of it. I got sweat, I got tears, I got emotion.
Oh my.
Thank you so much.
Boy, up close is something.
The table is open. I'm going to set you loose. So we're going to start here. You'll take the bread.
Which way?
You'll take the bread, dip it in the cup, and then go back to your seat. Then these two sections will take the bread, cup, and you'll go back this way. The table is open.